sounds like a dumb movie. I'm sure there's plenty of potheads who won't correct me on this. It's all funny.
The following is a Fanoff production.
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Erie International, episode 377, this week brought to you by fanoff.com. My name is David from the U.S. I don't know why I just completely broke down in my head, my usual spiel. Andy from Germany, help me, I'm drowning. What's going on?
Yeah, I will reintroduce you to the way that we had changed the intro on your behest.
I told you guys should have known before I started recording that every single step I was like, don't remember what we were doing.
Anyway, yeah, good to be back. Good to be the three of us again. And the third one is one Dave Roberts from the UK. Hey, Dave.
Hello, everybody. I hope everyone's having a good weekend. It's finally feeling like summer over here. Yes, we're back to weather reports. Like it or lump it. Nice and
classic
sunny.
Classic Erie.
Classic Erie International. It's 18 degrees here, but it feels a lot hotter because of that sun just beating down on us. It's a lovely day here in the UK. A week removed from Eurovision. And I have to admit something, Andy. I've still not watched it.
The Erie community is very disappointed in you. We will be flooded with emails.
I know. I didn't watch it on the night, and then I kind of got wind of what had happened. And I'll be honest with you, I wasn't sold on the UK's song anyway. I don't know if it's because I was annoyed at the fact that they destroyed a perfectly good XR3 in the video for the song, or because I just... When you're coming off the back of Sam Ryder, how do you improve on that? You don't, do you? So it was always going to be a hard job to follow. And that was proven to be the case. But I've heard wonderful things about the hosting. I've heard wonderful things about Mel Giedroyc as a Polish milkmaid churning
butter
in the
background. About the whole show. Because no one commented on it. She was just there in the background in one... moment, yeah. Just one minor scene. She's just there in the background. No one says anything about it. It's fantastic.
So I am going to watch it, but it's just it's just a matter of finding the time and initiative, because I've been having to watch a lot of anime this week, which I will probably mention at some point.
For a change.
I know, right? Yeah. I invented time again so that I could watch lots of anime. Yeah, how's the weather in your two distant climes, gentlemen?
Seems similar to yours. Sunny, warm. Supposed to be even sunnier and warmer tomorrow.
Nice.
So, yeah, it seems like summer is finally making its first tiny steps in 2023. To add my two cents to the Eurovision talk, it was the most boring show of... I've seen the most boring Eurovision in years. The most boring Eurovision I've seen since I started watching Eurovision again, like maybe 9 years ago or so. Mm. Didn't like none of the songs were particularly exciting to me, except for the actually UK entry. That's the one song that I really liked. Mm. The one song that I've listened to multiple times. So yeah, I get it if you're not too keen on making time to watch the whole affair.
Yeah, I'm going to anyway because of the fact it was in Liverpool. And I forget her name now, but the actress from Ted Lasso. Yeah.
Waddingham.
That's it, yes. Hannah Waddingham. She had a lovely dress on from the stills that I've seen, so I would very much like to watch that show. But yeah, David, weather report, please.
It's the same as you guys, nice. Which isn't that interesting. I wish it was a lot different, but I don't know what 18 degrees is in Fahrenheit.
Oh, that's right. You're using freedom height, aren't you?
Yeah. When you said it, I was like, that's cold as shit, man. That doesn't sound great at all.
I know. Probably like in the 70s or something. I'm just guessing.
That was going to be my guess based off of what it's been here. Yeah. Like mid to high 70s, and then it's been peaking into the 80s. So it's been getting hotter. But I'm actually pretty grateful for it because it's it means I can actually walk around my neighborhood and take scout on walks. It's not raining all the time.
Yeah.
So
rain is a absolute pox on dog walkers' lives. I hope never to have to put up with it again, but I know that I will have to. It's 65 degrees roughly Fahrenheit.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's not like, you know, it depends where you grow up, obviously, because I think I've mentioned this one before, but when I was in Florida and met up with Felipe and Mark and everyone else, I was walking around in like shorts and a t-shirt, loving life, and they were all in like hoodies and jeans and other, you know. And I was just like, I don't understand, Felipe, how you're walking toward... You walked here from your hotel, which is like a half-hour walk, and you're wearing a beanie hat. You're wearing multiple layers, and you've got like these thick jeans on, and you're not sweating at all. What the fuck? And it's just... It's the difference in growing up in different climates, isn't it? You know, like coming from the UK, I'm lucky that unless I go to Antarctica, I'm probably going to be able to pack the shorts. If you grew up in Indiana, I imagine that might be a little bit different.
Yeah, it really messed my baseline up because I was mostly born and raised up till 9 in Wisconsin and Michigan, which have really cold winters.
Yeah.
And then we moved to Brazil, like right under the equator, until I was 15, 16. And then we moved back to Indiana, which has not as harsh winters, but still it's the Midwest, still pretty cold. So I feel like I'm pissed off when it's too hot and I'm pissed off when it's too cold. That's what it's ended. I'm not the daywalker with the best of both worlds. I have the worst of both.
I was going to say, you're quite lucky to have moved to Brazil, which I believe is referred to as the Michigan of Latin America.
That's their what weather, they call us.
Yeah, the weather system is so similar.
Andy, I'll have you know that I remembered our old intro. Well, our new old intro.
Do you want to do it over?
Yeah, sure. what number is it again? I already forgot. 277.
377.
Hello and welcome. Oh shit, you're right. Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Ear International, episode 377. This week, I'm David from the United States.
I'm Andy from Germany.
I'm Dave from the UK. Woop, woop.
Hey, we can start now. Andy, actually, do you want to let the people know what we're doing this week since it was, I think, your idea?
Let me let the people know we are finally starting our three-part series on Clive Barker's Hellraiser universe, starting today with the original novella called The Hellbound Heart. It isn't actually called Hellraiser. And then a few years later, Clive Barker adapted his novella into a movie called Hellraiser. That will be our next episode. And then the third episode will be on the latest adaptation from last year that Dave Bruckner did, and that will be our series. But yeah, for today, another literary episode, which David hasn't been on our literary episodes last year. Last year, Dave and I did a whole series. We reviewed 14 short stories, I believe, something like that.
It was in that ballpark, yeah.
Yeah, one per week. But yeah, a literary episode with all three of us is something that we haven't done in a while.
Yeah, I'm excited. Also, I think it's funny that, and I know what you mean, and it was the right thing to say, but it's funny saying that this is our three-part series over the Hellraiser universe, where we talk about the very first thing and the very last thing and ignore the eight movies in between.
I mean, and several other
things. I don't
think
anyone will blame us.
There's an argument that several of those movies deserve to be completely ignored, to be fair.
Sure.
I mean, I'm sure we will talk about more movie stuff on the upcoming episodes.
Yeah, for sure.
But
for sure.
Just... And we're not even at our main topic yet, but anyway, I'm going to ask you, how many Hellraiser movies have you actually seen, Dave, first?
I think I've seen most of the first one, but as is usual with me, I've seen bits all over the place. I don't think I've ever sat down and watched the whole thing through from beginning to end.
And none of the sequels?
None of the sequels at all, no.
All right. David?
I'm a little bit more advanced than Dave. I have seen the whole first movie, and that's it.
Okay.
None of the sequels.
All right. I'm pretty sure I've seen the first three, although the third one only once, and probably back when it came out. So a long, long time ago. And parts one and two I rewatched maybe 10 years ago or so.
Okay. So, yeah. Hellraiser, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more next week too, but the my intro to Hellraiser, just watching, or like the universe, these characters, was the first movie, and it was during the little period where that October I watched 31 plus horror movies for the first time, which was the birth of this podcast. So, or kind of like the initial step for it. So I associate it with that for sure. But I have a lot more to say about all of this stuff. Let's get to the episode. Sorry.
Right. Let's begin with housekeeping.
Yeah.
As we sometimes do, most of the time. We can be found on social media, of course. On Twitter, we are at @ERIENT. On Facebook and Instagram, we are Eerie International. And we do have an email account. It's ERIEinternational@gmail.com. We received two emails over the past 2 weeks, because we didn't record last week. Our friend Elio sent us an email for last week, basically, and then we didn't record, and then he added another one this week because he was very excited about our Hellraiser series. So I have pulled up his first email. So, Bucklin, this will take a while. Two long emails, although we might wait with the second email for the later part of the show when we actually talk about Hellraiser. So first, his non-Hellraiser related email. Hey guys, so I haven't started the Hellraiser stuff, but I wanted to send in an email regardless of some of the coolest stuff I've enjoyed lately and a question or two. Right, there was a question. I reminded you two times and then I forgot today, but I have answers.
Classic Andy.
I mean, I already jotted down answers 2 weeks ago when this email came in. So, anyway, back to the email. So the big movie I really want to talk about is Evil Dead Rise. I thought it was really good. It was reminiscent of Evil Dead 1 and the 2013 remake more than anything else. It was over the top with gore and guts and incredibly dark, but it didn't have a ton of the slapstick that 2, Army of Darkness, and The Show had. I greatly enjoyed it and was happy I saw it opening night. I started playing Resident Evil 8 Village, and it's pretty gruesome. I really enjoy it because it's like a dramatic pastiche of some huge horror tropes. Werewolves, Frankensteins, vampires, killer dolls, etc. It definitely plays out like a 50s horror movie and is incredibly fun. I also want to share about an experience I had watching Jaws with a friend. It was her first time seeing the movie, and it was just such a fun viewing experience. It leads me to my question. Do any of you have a favorite viewing experience memory, whether it be time and place or a certain audience or maybe even seeing the movie with a certain person? My girlfriend and I saw a 33mm, I'm pretty sure it's 35mm, Friday the 13th Part 1 showing by ourselves at a small local theater, and I really look back at it as a delightful and important memory. The episodes have been great and I have been happily listening along. Hope you have a great week. Big L. He's calling himself Big L now. So, favorite viewing experiences. Do any of you have a favorite memory of a specific viewing experience of a movie? David?
I have a ton. I mean, just to kind of bullet list the first ones that come to my head, a few of them I've talked about on the show before, I'm sure. The first one being one I know I've talked about, which is when I first saw Evil Dead. Because it was, I guess you can define it as a viewing experience. It was when I was over at a friend's house. A bunch of us were crashing at his place. This was in Brazil. And we all fell asleep talking with the TV on. And I woke up in the middle of the night and the sound was all the way down, but it was playing Evil Dead. And it was just the shots of the girl underneath the trap door and looking and talking and all that. And I was so captivated by it and creeped out by it. And then for years, I didn't know what it was. But that one definitely burned in. And then I've got a ton that are just, like great, memorable, either because it's a special kind of event or with a certain circumstances. I remember seeing Freaks at midnight on Halloween one year with some people. That was a lot of fun. Mentioned Jaws. When I first saw Jaws, I didn't have the like watch it in the water experience, but the first time I watched it as a kid, I was at a friend's house in Brazil. These were American friends who were there. Their dad was working some job. I don't remember exactly how it was all connected, but they were rich, so they lived on the beach, like literally on the beach, in like a high-rise apartment. So I watched that at their place, this high-rise apartment with the windows open where we could just see the ocean in the dark. And that like kind of always imprinted onto my memory of seeing that movie. I think about that every time I watch it. So yeah, I mean, I could go on and on with all kinds of, you know, different specifics, but, yeah, those are the first that come to my head. What about you, Dave?
I don't have too many. I had one that was specific to horror, which I wanted to mention. I'm sure I've mentioned this on the show before, but I'll just mention it again. It wasn't actually at the screening of a horror movie. Which is probably why the reaction was so good. But we went to watch a random film. I can't remember what it was. And the trailers came on beforehand. And the cinema is kind of like half full, as they tend to be when, you know, you're not watching a blockbuster on night of release. And The Conjuring, the trailer for The Conjuring spin-off with the doll, Abigail, whatever her name was,
Annabelle,
that's it. I got the right first letter, give me credit.
I'm gonna start calling it that, Abigail creation.
So you remember the trailer where they've got that shot of the door swinging backwards and forwards on the double hinge, and suddenly this woman comes kind of like charging out from the door.
Oh yeah.
So we're watching the trailer, and there's this group of lads sitting a couple of rows in front of us, and they're all kind of like your typical kind of like, you know, ooh, nothing scares me, mate. And then she bursts through the door, and this guy two rows in front goes, ah! And everybody just burst out laughing. And it was just like one of my favorite reactions I've ever seen from someone in a cinema. It's very rare, because I've talked about on the show that I don't really watch out and out horror movies in the cinema, except for that one time when I watched Conjuring 2. I rarely bother. I normally watch kind of like action horror, you know, a hybrid comedy yeah. horror or something like that. So you don't really get those real visceral reactions that you can't control. So to have that in a movie that we weren't expecting it in the trailers was a really fun experience. And it was just the way that everybody just kind of laughed in a really, it wasn't like a mean way, it was a good natured way, like, well, I'm embarrassed for you because that could have been me, you know.
Oh yeah.
And also
I had that happen to me where I was that guy one time.
Oh no.
it was one of the Paranormal Activity movies. I don't remember, it was either the second or the third, and there's a scene where one of the characters is in the kitchen. And the setup is that like one of the cabinets or the drawers are open. So she closes it, leaves the room, comes back in, and like a different one is open, or maybe the same one's open again. And so like clearly you're like, okay, it's something weird is going on. She closes those. And then either it's right then or it's later in the movie. She's back in the kitchen, and it's an awesome effect. It doesn't look like CG. I think it's practical, or at least it looks practical. Every single drawer and cabinet in the kitchen slams open at the same time, like all of them.
Nice.
And it's a great like jump scare or whatever. But right in the span of it happening and loud enough that people around me, especially Austin, who was sitting next to me, could hear, it was just like all the air escaped my body through my mouth. Where I was just like, like it was just,
yeah.
It's completely involuntary.
I know exactly the kind of sound that you're talking about. I'm sure I've done that at least once myself. Oh, man.
Anyway.
It's the best noise because it's completely unfiltered. You know,
And I think you're right that when people laugh, it's good. It's kind of good natured because it's like,
shit,
it's such a human,
exactly.
reaction.
Yeah. There's only one other, actually. Like, I was racking my brains trying to think, and then I just came to the conclusion that I've not really had that many standout experiences. Like, I've gone to watch movies and I've really enjoyed them. You know, I've been lucky enough to go to back when IMAX was still a relatively rare thing in the UK, I went to watch the second Matrix movie, which I know this will surprise a lot of people because of what I've said about the Matrix sequels in over the years, but went to watch the second Matrix movie at the BFI Institute in London, which was, I think, like the only true IMAX screen in the south of England at that point, at least. And that was a really cool experience because I'd never seen anything on that scale before. Like, the screen was absolutely ginormous. I mean, pretty much everyone has been to IMAX at this point, so they know what I'm talking about. But the BFI one specifically is such an experience because of the location of the building, how you get to it. That's pretty cool. And then the last one was also a time when I went to see a film or films at a cinema in London. I couldn't tell you the name of the cinema. I know it was somewhere in the vicinity of Oxford Street. But there was essentially like an anime convention or festival going on at this cinema. And they were showing a bunch of movies back to back along with premieres of episodes of TV shows. So we went to this thing and ended up watching, because I was at the time hugely into Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex. The reason that we went specifically was because they were showing Standalone Complex Solid State Society, which was the feature-length movie that was based around the Standalone Complex characters and character design. But also they showed a couple of episodes of Le Chevalier d'Eon, which is, if nobody's heard of it, it's actually a really cool horror-themed anime based in Regency France during the reign of one of the Louis. I can't tell you which one. The idea is that there are kind of like zombies involved, and the main character is possessed by the spirit of his sister, who may have been a secret agent for the king, and so he goes back between being himself and being her. She kind of takes over his body and stuff, and it's a really weird show, but it was really fun, and I ended up buying the entirety of it on DVD when it came out officially in the UK off the back of watching it. But the actual experience I really enjoyed was the fact that I was just sitting for the first time that I was aware of, I was sitting in a room with a bunch of people that were interested in anime, and we were just sitting there and intently watching it and having an absolutely fantastic time. Like, you could hear a pin drop at times. Everyone was really invested. And that's more and more of a common thing now. Like, recently Suzume was released in Europe, and so me and my friend Ryan, who was actually with me at this other thing with Le Chevalier, we ended up going to watch that, and again we had that kind of feeling of being surrounded by people that were of the same interests that we were, and it made for like this really cool communal experience, which you don't necessarily get with all films, but I think you feel that with certain filmmakers' stuff, like Kevin Smith. I know, like, when you go to watch a Kevin Smith movie, you know that almost everyone else in that cinema is there because they like Kevin Smith, rather than, what are we going to watch this weekend? Well, why don't we watch the movie from that guy who made Dogma, or, you know, made the movie about the shit monster, or the guy that got turned into a walrus. Yeah.
Man, I was hoping you were going to go with another Dogma for your third one, and just three from Dogma.
Just three from Dogma, yeah. Well, I serve to disappoint. So, yeah, that's probably the main ones for me. I can't really think of too many others. Andy, what about you?
Yeah, I immediately wrote down a few when I read Elio's email originally, and just as David mentioned, I think there's probably way more than these, if I really think about them. But these came to mind immediately, so I'm going to talk about these. And the first one is actually at least the second viewing of the movie, similar to what Dave just described. My first viewing of this movie was on a plane, so I have two memorable plane movie experiences.
Not usually the case.
Right. And the first one is Your Name. And yes. With Your Name, as I just mentioned, I have two memorable viewing experiences. The first one was on a plane. That was the first time I saw the movie. And the second one was then actually at a cinema, just as Dave just described, with hundreds of people who were only there to see this one specific movie, who had waited maybe a couple of years because it took quite some time for this movie to be released in Germany. So, and the first time I saw it was on a plane on our way back from my first trip to Tokyo. And Dave and David had already told me about this film. David, I think, was the first one who had sent the trailer for this movie at some point. I didn't quite know what to make of it. And then on our way home from Tokyo, in the row in front of me, someone was watching an animated movie. And I don't know why, but for some reason, my mind went to, maybe that's that movie that Dave and David had talked about. I don't know why I thought that, but I did. So I looked up and yeah, it was Your Name. So I thought to myself, okay, let's watch Your Name then. And the movie was fantastic, even just watching it on the plane. And then Bianca watched it as well. And then when the movie came out in Germany, maybe half a year later or so, we went to that screening with hundreds, literally hundreds of people. And the movie just worked fantastically for every single person in that room. It was just a very special energy in that room because everyone enjoyed that movie too much because it is the damn best movie ever. So yeah, two very different viewings of the same movie, both very memorable to me. Second movie I watched on a plane that was very special was One Cut of the Dead. A movie that hadn't been released in Germany yet. It played Fantasy Film Fest, but that year, that specific year, it didn't play in Nuremberg, where I'm going to the festival. It only played in other cities. So we weren't able to see it. And then, of course, we had heard how great it is and everything. And it was in 2019, and while we were in the States, and we went from Austin, Texas to wherever we went next. And just, I don't know, a couple of days or so before we went on the next flight, I listened to the then current episode of Shockwaves. And Elric Kane talked about how he had some waiting time at an airport and interacted with people on Twitter, and someone suggested to him that if you're flying with a specific line, they have One Cut of the Dead in their onboard entertainment. And so the next time we boarded a plane, which was literally that explained from Austin to wherever, and the flight was relatively short, but we said, okay, let's As soon as we're on board, let's look if they have that movie, and then we're gonna watch that movie. And yeah, it was the case. They had the movie. We had pretty much only time to watch that movie, which isn't very long, but we managed to watch the movie.
Flight attendants are coming by, and you're like, no, shut the fuck up. Go. I don't care. Stop talking to me.
And again, movie's great. We did an episode on it later on here on Eerie. Yeah. And yeah, it was a great experience.
I guess I have a memorable experience watching that movie too, because I watched that racist pirated version that somebody put on Amazon Prime for 24 hours that set Twitter on fire. Anyway, yeah, we've recommended it a million times, but if you haven't seen it, watch that movie. It's so good. Andy, so, I thought you had more. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, no, you cut out a little for me, so I wasn't
okay, my bad.
Exactly sure if you were done. Yeah, just recently, when I watched Babylon on my own at the cinema, that was like a transcendental experience, which in that moment, on that day, in that screening, the movie and myself, we were just made for each other. That was when I left the cinema, I didn't put my headphones in because I just couldn't, because I needed to stay with my emotions and I needed to keep that music in my head, and the way home I was like in a trance, and yeah, that was fantastic. House of a Thousand Corpses, a movie that I did see at Fantasy Film Fest. A movie that I had seen the trailer years before, and then they shelved the movie. They didn't release it. And then when they did release it, they showed it at Fantasy Film Fest. I saw it there, and I was so excited afterwards because I had seen that movie. Back then, it wasn't... it was still a pretty rare experience to see such movies in a cinema, especially in Germany. So yeah, that one always stays in my mind. And one of my very favorite stories that I just keep telling and have told for years now was when I and my friend Dirk, who both of you have met, went to see Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York. Maybe I've told this story before, I don't know. So we watched Gangs of New York. Pretty long movie, don't remember exactly how long, but still. Long movie about the building of America, a very American movie. It's all about America. And then over the end credits, you two sing the song called The Hands That Built America. It's all about America. So for hours, you're in this world, you're in America, and to its core, couldn't be more American. Movie's over, curtains close, the lights go up, the house music comes on again over the house speakers. So this is not planned, this is just randomly. The song that is playing at the moment when the movie is over, curtains close, and the house music comes on, and the song is David Bowie, This Is Not America.
So I was so close. I was going to guess David Bowie, Trent Reznor, I'm Afraid of Americans.
I was hoping for that one as well.
That's even better.
Yeah, because the curtains close, lights go up, you are back in your own world, and even the house music tells you this is not America.
I didn't realize Trent Reznor worked on this. I'm Afraid of Americans.
I think there's two versions of it. Because I know there's a music video with both of them in it.
I think he redid it later with them. I'll definitely look into it because I've got a version of it on the Best of Bowie double CD that was released years ago. So I can absolutely see that being something that Reznor may have worked on.
Oh, once you hear it, you'll be able to tell the difference quickly because it sounds like Nine Inch Nails.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah, it's a good song.
That's awesome. This is not America.
I think I talked about too. No, I can't. I can't keep telling stories. We have so much to do. Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm done.
Well, I mean, yeah, with that or the rest of the letter, whatever.
Okay, so I guess we will keep the second email because that one is specifically about the Hellbound Heart. Let's keep that second email to that portion of the podcast. And now we can talk about stuff that we did over the past 2 weeks that we want to mention. I have 1.5 things. listeners may remember that Laird Barron had very severe health issues recently, went to the hospital and still is in recovery, but he's doing way better, and he was on the Lovecraft E-Zine podcast recently, just this past week, to promote his new novella. That's the half thing. I bought his new novella.
I did too. I mean, has yours arrived yet or no?
I bought it on Kindle.
Oh, okay.
So I did arrive.
I'm still waiting for my copy to get here. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it was. I think I paid like quarter of what I would have had to pay for a print copy here. So, because import is expensive.
Yeah.
The Wind Began to Howl is a novella set in the Isaiah Coleridge series. So it's a new Isaiah Coleridge story. There's three novels released by Putnam, and Putnam decided not to release any more, and now Laird Barron released this novella with a smaller indie publisher. Anyway, so he was on the Lovecraft E-Zine podcast. They talked a lot about the novella, of course, but also about his health, the whole experience. There's John Langan is like a recurring panelist on the podcast, and several other people as well. I haven't listened to an episode in some time, but it's a podcast that we've mentioned over the years many times. It is, I think, at least to me, the best podcast about, or the best discussions about horror literature and great interviews with horror writers. Lad Baron has been on the podcast many times. So yeah, if you are, as we are, a fan of Lad Baron's, and if you are happy to see him doing better, you can either watch on YouTube or listen to the podcast on any podcast platform, Lovecraft Easy Podcast with Lad Baron, talking about The Wind Began to Howl.
I am excited. I need to read the third Coleridge novel. I was actually just in Chicago a couple weekends ago with Austin, and we went to Bucket of Blood, which is a horror bookstore I've mentioned, I think, a couple times in the past. And I have bought so many Laird Barron books there. Like, anytime I've gone there in the past, I usually get at least one. And this last time I was like, there's only one left. Swift to Chase is the last one I didn't have. So I picked that up. And Austin and I were talking about him a bunch at afterward, and I was just, you know, he hasn't read any of his stuff yet, and I was just talking about how legitimately great it is, and just, you know, the amount of excitement and just discussion that we had out of doing The Beautiful Thing That Awaits Us All each week, and how great that was. Anyway, yeah, excited to read it, and really excited and happy. Excited is a weird word for that. Happy that he is okay, because if you've anyone followed that stuff on Twitter, it sounds like he was a couple inches away from death, pretty bad. So
on the podcast, he says that one of the doctors told him it was a matter of hours.
Wow, that's insane, crazy, cool.
Yeah,
well,
David,
not cool, but you know,
you want to take over?
Sure, I've got a few things. I'll just hit them fast. I ended up on a little bit of a Ridley Scott kick. I just randomly one night put on Prometheus, a movie I've seen many times. Hadn't seen it in a little bit. I love the movie. I think it's awesome. I know people get so hung up and caught up on the stuff that everybody talks about with these movies, like, why didn't she run to the left when the thing was rolling, and why'd they take their helmets off? I'm at the point now with that stuff where I just don't care. I can't care, because it's so insanely minor to the rest of the movie. And I'm not saying the movie is perfect, but the sense of wonder, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. There are few movies where I feel that sense of like adventure and anticipation of seeing something that no one has seen before. So when they arrive on the planet in Prometheus, and when they turn that corner and seeing, you know, that long straight pathway with the buildings and stuff, and who are these engineers, and that sort of sense of exploration. I honestly don't even really think about it as an alien movie. I know it's connected to the franchise. Obviously I don't mean like with xenomorphs and stuff, but it's so kind of separate in my head that it just exists as this really awesome sci-fi movie with some horror elements. The stuff with the android is so good and so well done. Fassbender's great. So as soon as that ended, I just rolled right into Alien Covenant, or Oven Cant, whatever we used to call it. I found that picture the other day, Dave, that you sent of a bus in London that had it set up incorrectly. I hadn't seen this since the movie came out. I remember some of the discussion around it when it came out, and people were sort of divided. I don't know, man, watching it, especially now following it up and seeing the sense of scale, the same sort of sense of especially the android stuff. I think it's great. I loved it. It goes way more horror, obviously, than Prometheus, but I don't know. I'm just really into the way Ridley Scott does these movies. His entries in the franchise are my favorite. I love Aliens, obviously. We all do. It's a great movie. But I like the Ridley Scott approach to how he does the stuff and the themes and the metaphors. It's just all very much my speed. So I won't go into this one, but I then watched The Last Duel, which I hadn't seen. Liked it a lot. Another Ridley Scott movie. The only other thing I watched that's horror is a movie called Fresh, which came out last year. I don't know if you guys did you guys do it on the show, or I think Andy, you've seen it at least.
I have seen it. We did not do it on the show, but
okay.
That was the interesting thing about that movie was that as we did receive an email from a person who we had never heard from before or after. It was a fantastic email that we did get. It was very kind, and that person was very interested in us doing an episode on Fresh. Sadly, we never heard back from the person.
I did not know this. I'm going to have to go back and look and find it. Yeah.
But yeah, we haven't done an episode on it yet, but I have seen it. Yeah.
Well, in case we do, I won't go into too many. Well, not that I would spoil the movie anyway. I liked it a lot. I was pretty surprised by how into it I was. It's more of a thriller. Definitely horror in it, for sure. And it earns its horror label, I would say. But yeah, just as like a straight up twisty, I recommended it to someone and I was like, it's kind of like a Lifetime movie on coke or something. I don't know what drug you would put in there to make it insane, but it has all these like really fun thrillery twists in it that for whatever reason for me really worked. I think the script earns it in a lot of ways. I thought it was really well written, and it has this like it has grounded performances from some people and really unhinged ones from others. I don't know. It was a cool blend. What did you like it, Andy? I think I saw that Bianca did.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked it.
You don't really put good score. So I wasn't sure. Yeah. What did you say? Sorry.
I liked it a lot. I thought it was really
good. You did. Okay. Okay. Cool. Yeah. So yeah, I won't go into more spoilers in case we do it or like more discussion of like the specifics, but yeah, I was really into it. I think it was directly released on Hulu. So I think there was part of me that was, or streaming or whatever, at least here.
I know it was on Disney Plus in the UK, so there's a very good chance it was Hulu or something related. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was kind of, I don't know, not that all of those movies have that feel, but a lot of times that you kind of, I think just subconsciously click into like, okay, well, I'm watching this. It's a movie, but I'm watching it at home. I don't know. And it had a lot more depth to it than I expected. I was pretty into it. Very cool. I think that's it for me. Didn't really do anything else. I played some Dead by Daylight with my sisters. That was actually really fun. One of my sisters is insanely good at it, which the other two siblings did not know. So that was crazy. And it was my youngest sister, who historically has never played video games, even though my other sister and I always have. So that was a pretty fun night of our youngest sister, like, going into, like, min-maxing and explaining the best ways to do everything in Dead by Daylight. But that's a really fun, like, cooperative, what are they called? Asymmetrical games? Yeah. Is that what it is, Dave? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've played as the survivors. Yeah, if you can find a group that's able to communicate, especially over to like obviously chat and stuff, really cool horror vibes. Obviously, there's a ton of DLC, so you can see all like Ash and Michael Myers and all these horror icons are in it too. So that's it for me, Dave.
Not much to report on this week or this last couple of weeks, but I will just mention the fact that I started to get properly back into Vinland Saga over the last week. Season 2 has charmingly been called Farmland Saga by some people that have watched it because it's so different tonally from the first season. First season was very much about Thorfinn, the main character, being part of a kind of privateer army, and so there was an awful lot of battles and fights and gruesome decapitations and amputations and things like that. Second season is basically about growing wheat, and I'm not even joking.
Riveting,
yeah. But somehow it is riveting. This is the weird thing. For a character to have done such a 180, going from like a bloodthirsty killer to being almost a pacifist, It's a really fascinating turn of events. I am hoping that we get back to more of the stuff that we know from this show, but so far it's been pretty good. There have been, just to keep people happy, there have been moments where other characters have done their fair share of mauling and maiming and killing. So there's still a lot of that stuff going on, but just not from the main character. He's more worried about pulling up tree stumps so that he can plant his wheat and buy his freedom. So there's that. And I've been watching a show called Chainsaw Man, which I think some people may have heard of. Basic concept is that there are devils that are alive in the world, and they are hunted by devil hunters. And these devil hunters are either privateers or they're government sponsored. The main character of the show is a young man who has basically been, he's had a shitty life. He's paying off debts his father accrued before he killed himself. He's got a pet devil, which is a little dog with a chainsaw that comes out of its head. Through a series of events, he ends up being recruited as a state-sponsored devil hunter. And it's just, the opening music is absolutely an earworm. It will get in your head and it will not leave. They mix up the end themes, so there's a good variety of different themes there, including one from everyone's favourite Japanese band, Maximum the Hormone, who probably came to prominence mainly due to their work on the opening and closing themes for Death Note back in the day. That's a really fun show. It's only 12 episodes long, but it's definitely one that I would recommend people check out. I believe it's available on Netflix in the US. In the UK, no such luck. I've had to find other ways of watching it. I shan't go into that. But it's a very good...
It's on Hulu as well, I believe.
Oh, cool. Okay,
I watched the first episode of it. I forgot to tell you that.
Oh, nice.
When I got my most recent tattoo, the tattoo artist, she mentioned she had been watching it and she was into it. So I watched the first episode when I got home. And too.
It's definitely a show that if you enjoy the first episode, then the rest of it is just going to get you more and more into it. Because it's difficult to explain it, but there's... I normally think that if you can't get someone interested in your show within two or three episodes, then you've probably failed. The first episode is good enough in itself to get you interested, but from the second episode onwards, it really does kind of set the scene and get you... it leaves you in no doubt as to how the show is going to be going forward. It's made... I think it was animated by MAPPA, who are doing a lot of good stuff at the moment, including Vinland Saga. I can hear someone Googling to make sure they're a very good animation house, and I'm pretty sure it is MAPPA, because I think I had to look this shit up earlier. It's a good show, and it's got a lot of Hollywood references. Apparently, outside of maybe Reservoir Dogs and The Big Lebowski, have not picked up on many of them. But apparently there are an awful lot of Hollywood references. And I hope that there are a lot of Hollywood references, because they're literally the only thing that will keep Tyler interested in this show when we when we review it eventually on Generation Animation.
It is MAPPA. You got it right.
It is. Cool. Okay. At least I know some things. I can retain information sometimes if I really, really try. That's pretty much everything that I've been doing this week. I have listened to... an audiobook version of the Hellbound Heart. I read the book and then I kept kind of being distracted by stuff, so I ended up listening to it on YouTube while reading it along where I could. So it's a very good version. I'll link it in the episode description for people that want to listen to it. I think it's a fan-made reading, Mr. H or something like that. But he's a British guy. He's got a very, very good, very... baritone kind of voice, and I literally you start the video and it's like The Hellbound Heart by Clive Barker. And it's like, holy shit, I hope he reads everything exactly like this. And he does. So, yeah, that's definitely worth people's time if they haven't necessarily got the time to sit down and read it. Because I know that, and this is the thing, I don't think any of us here are snobbish about this. I know Lana, who listens, isn't snobbish about this. Because I think at one point the question did come up, if you listen to the audiobook of a version of something, can you say that you've read it? And I think you can claim that to a point.
Yes.
Obviously, you've not physically read it, but you have experienced the story. So I think
There's no difference to your brain.
Yeah, yeah. So it's definitely a very worthy version. Having
I
read
say along, that as someone who is not a scientist.
having read along while listening to it, it is word for word. And if
Daniel asked me about that the other day. He was like, "Well, I've been listening to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but I haven't read it." And he's sick, so I was trying to squash that immediately. It was like, "No. If you're listening to it, you know, I understand what you're saying, but like, it's still good. It's still good for you. There's a reason that they tell parents all the time when they're growing up, like, read to them every night, read to them as much as possible.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you have the time, read. If you don't, listen." That's perfectly fine. I have listened to a lot more Terry Pratchett books than I've read, and I'm not ashamed of that at all, because the guy was a funny fucker, and the audiobook versions are very well done as well. So I think that's pretty much everything, probably. You'd worry if I started forgetting about horror stuff that I'd watched, wouldn't you? Because I very rarely bother. I think that's everything.
Cool. All right. Is there anything else we're forgetting, Andy, before we jump into our main topic?
Nope.
Okay. Man, I don't know if that happened at the same time for you guys, but I heard someone in the background say no. Right.
Yeah,
Mum did hear that too.
Yeah. So Mum is currently stopping Poppy from burying her head under Granddad Smalls.
Poppy's their dog. It was just crazy how specifically timed it was as an answer.
Anyway, I'll let her know what's going on in a second. So
I wasn't making fun of her. It's just crazy. Okay, cool. Let's jump into it. Hellbound Heart, a story that I thought until when was it, Andy? A week or two ago was part of Books of Blood. I thought forever that this was a story somewhere in there. But as Andy mentioned, it is a standalone thing, not called Hellraiser. And it was originally published in... Andy,
let me read just the Wikipedia entry as to introduce it. So The Hellbound Heart is a horror novella by Clive Barker, first published in November 1986 by Dark Harvest in the third volume of its Night Visions anthology series. The story features a hedonist criminal acquiring a mystical puzzle box, the Le Marchand configuration, which can be used to summon the Cenobites, demonic beings who do not distinguish between pain and pleasure. He escapes the Cenobites and, with help, resorts to murder to restore himself to full life. Later on, the puzzle box is found by another. So yeah, originally it was part of an anthology, and I believe here it says in 1999 it was released as a standalone title by Harper Paperbacks, and that was after the success of the movie. First released in 86.
I don't know if you said this because I was flipping through my book at the same time. Edited by George R. R. Martin, I think.
Wikipedia did not tell me that.
Where did I see this? I saw the cover somewhere. It was a Ramsey Campbell story. I forget who the other person was. And then Clive Barker was third billed on the cover. I don't know if George R. R. Martin edited every issue, but it says... edited by George R. R. Martin on the front, underneath the big logo title or whatever.
Is this why he can't finish his own bloody books? He's editing everyone else's.
This is before he even started Game of Thrones.
Are we sure? It takes him forever to finish a book.
You're right. Andy, what did you think of this book overall?
To make it short, I loved it. I had a great time reading the book. I was very much into the style, into the prose, into the story. As I mentioned, I have seen the movie a few times, but pretty long ago. So I'm very curious to revisit the movie. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed the book. Dave, what did you think?
I really enjoyed it as well. From my memory of the bits of the film that I had seen, sorry for that, the dog is still trying to bite my mum to death. She succeeded. From my memory of what I've seen of the film, it felt like the two of them are very, very close together, if not identical, because we have spoken about books that films were either based off of or books that were novelizations of movies, and they've had slight differences to them, or they've had major differences to them. The only real difference that I can glean is the fact that I think The Hellbound Heart might actually be set in the UK. They never specifically say so, and there are Newcastles all over the world. But at one point, one of the victims is described as coming from Newcastle on business. And given that Clive Barker is English, Welsh, I think, actually.
Born in Liverpool, as
born in Liverpool, that's right, not Welsh at all. Yes, he's a Scouser. I would surmise that the book is probably based in the UK, while the movie, for obvious reasons, is based in America. But other than that, it's very, very similar. It's really well written. At times, it has the feeling of... I've been re-listening to a lot of My Dad Wrote a Porno recently, the podcast series. And at times, it has very similar language. And I'm like, did Rocky Flintstone write this? you know, it's like, he grabbed his cock and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, right, fine. But it's, I never get the feeling that it's trying to be shocking for shock's sake. Like, it's all linked into the greater narrative of the story. And it all makes sense. Like, you know, that when they're in his brain, and you know, they've got all these visions, and he just basically gets himself out and jerks himself off. That has a purpose because of how he ends up coming back. Like, the explanation as to what it is that brought him back. He left some of himself in his previous life, and that was kind of like the key to opening the gateway to coming back to this existence. But I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's short enough that you can. I mean, I know, Andy, you got through it in basically one train ride.
Yeah,
I think if I was so inclined, I could probably sit down and finish this in one go. Although my attention isn't necessarily as focused, even when I'm really into something, I can quite often get distracted quite easily. As it is, this was over maybe three or four sittings that I got through this, both by reading and listening to. But it's really engaging, and it takes a little bit of time to get started. That might be my one slight criticism, is that it really kind of feels like it takes its time to actually get into it, even though we literally open with him, you know, calling the Cenobites to existence. It somehow, the book doesn't really feel like it gets going until here I go struggling with names again. Until what's her face kills the first victim, at which point it really seems to clip along very quickly indeed. So I don't know if that's a pacing thing or if it's just my impatience to get to the good shit. And it depends what your idea of good shit is. If it's a guy jerking himself off in a dark room, then, you know, fine. With a jug of piss in one corner. And, you know, I mean, that sounds like a good Saturday night to me. I like the murders. The murders were the good bit for me. And the description of how his body was clinging together and regenerating, that felt very much like straight out of the film. And the description of the Cenobites as well was actually pretty good. Obviously, Pinhead was mentioned there, and if you went off of the book, you wouldn't think that Pinhead was the kind of poster child for Hellraiser, would you? But knowing what we know about the film and the marketing, like, Pinhead really has become kind of like the iconic... it's become the iconic Cenobite, the one that is referenced in almost all materials. I get the feeling from the book that it was meant to be the kind of stretch-faced guy. I can't remember the other ones as well, to be fair, but maybe that's why Pinhead is so memorable or such a figurehead. But it feels like feels like Hollywood focused on one of them, whereas the books would have had you focus on another. That's pretty much all I've got for the time being.
For me, where do I land on this? I liked it. I didn't like it as much as you guys, I don't think. My issues with it are pretty much 100% subjective. Like, I mean, not obviously everything is, but this would be something where I would totally be like, I struggled a little bit with his style, just in terms of like preference. There was one thing I think is probably just because he was a much younger writer, but this motherfucker says the word din, D-I-N, in this book probably 408 times. I don't know if you guys noticed it, but I noticed it pretty early on and then I couldn't stop. He uses it so much. But the style thing, I totally get why Andy, you mentioned really liking the style. We can get more into this, obviously. Because for me, it wasn't a thing where I was like, oh, this guy sucks or he's a hack. It wasn't anything like that, as much as it was just kind of like, for me, it didn't click. At times it did. I didn't think it was bad writing, but I felt like there's a lot more writing than needed to happen, if that makes sense. In some cases, like, it kind of felt like he was often reaching for words he didn't have to. But I could also see how that would be stylistically appealing. So it's not really, again, something that I am critical of as much as just kind of saying, like, I don't know, it didn't really, for whatever reason, click with me. That being said, this was the most I've ever liked the franchise, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, was this iteration of it. 'Cause and we'll talk about the movie next week. My memory of watching the movie, you know, so many years ago, was that I thought it was not overrated, but I was just kind of like, oh, okay. I didn't love it. I didn't dislike it. I was just kind of lukewarm on it. And didn't have much interest in going beyond that. With this, I felt much more drawn to all of the ceremony of the supernatural stuff. At times it reminded me of a Dark Song movie I've talked about a bunch of times on the show that I really liked. This approach to, you know, people tampering with magic, or, you know, magical things that can, you know, tear the fabric of reality and let us see into other places or crossover, you know, whatever, you know, thing it is, whether it's specifically hell or not. I really liked all of that stuff in the book specifically. All the stuff with the Cenobites I really liked as well. It felt very weird fiction, cosmic-y fiction, way more than I was expecting. I only read one or two short stories by Nathan Ballingrud, in that, is it called Wounds? I think Wounds is the name, or maybe they renamed it that. But it had a similar thing where it's like you're dealing with artifacts and characters and locations to where it's very clear that there exists this other awful place and these other awful things that we can't wrap our heads around, and we're powerless against them. It's not even a thing where they're a threat that we then have to figure out how to take down. It's just we have no way of fighting them. This is not a thing to do other than just to survive or avoid. I loved all of that stuff, how the Cenobites spoke to them. I liked the idea that he was able to escape, and then she, Kirsty, kind of helps them. Is it Kirsty or Christy? It's Kirsty, right?
Oh,
K-I-R.
It doesn't
look it up.
Kirsty, I think.
I have the book right here. I don't know why, I just didn't check. Kirsty, yeah. Kirsty, however you want to pronounce it, but yeah. I liked the arc of her character and the idea. One of my favorite sort of twists in the book was when suddenly she has the box and is messing with it in the hospital, and this very, you know, meek, unassuming, sort of scared character in the book that has kind of just been a nuisance. Even she, to the other horrible characters, I'm not criticizing her, but she even views herself as a nuisance, giving her a lot more suddenly power in that game, I thought was awesome. And the way that they handled all that stuff. So yeah, I definitely liked it. I don't know. I'm trying to think if I've ever read anything else by Barker. I feel like, have we done anything on the show?
That's actually something that I wanted to ask you guys, if you had read any other stories by Clive Barker. We haven't discussed his literature yet on the show. I read The Midnight Meat Train when we did an episode on the movie.
That's what I was going to... That's the only thing I couldn't remember is if we did both on that episode, but
no,
sounds like no.
We had... I believe it was Theron? We had a guest on for that show. I believe it was Theron, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I'd be curious. I have other stuff by Clive Barker. I don't think I've read any of it from what I can remember. I have Mr. Be Gone, I think is the name of it, another novel. And so I don't know. I'd like to read more of his stuff to see, okay, is this... it could be any number of things. It could be a stylistic choice for this particular type of story. It could be, you know, his voice in his early years was something that I doesn't work as well for me. I have no idea. As with anything else, I mean, I've gotten to the point in life, too, where I'm just like, I could probably read this again next week and have a totally different experience with it. There's just so many factors and everything else. But yeah, I dug it. I also find it interesting and cool that this isn't something he revisited for a long time, from what I read, at least. I don't think it was until the novel that he did and came out in the past 5-10 years, maybe. That revisits, I think, from what I read, the Cenobite, or at least, you know, Pinhead's character, who I believe is called the Hell Priest, and like this world, he's not called Pinhead. So it's pretty awesome that he has this sort of universe that exists way beyond this stuff, but this stuff is a very small amount, relatively speaking.
You mean this is a shared universe? His ears pricked up in anticipation.
I actually think the newer novel is a shared universe because he has like an occult detective character, Henry Damore, I think is his name.
It's Harry.
Harry. And I know he shows up in other, is he in Lord of Illusions maybe? Yeah. I know he's the main character. Okay. And other Barker stuff. I believe he is the main character in that novel that features the Hell Priest. So I know he at least has that part of it shared. Dave, in case that's a rabbit hole you want to go down.
Yeah, that's what it says on Wikipedia. So in 2015, he released The Scarlet Gospels.
That's what it's called.
And then there was another novel in 2018 where Clive Barker only provided the story, and the book was written by Mark Allen Miller. And yeah, The Scarlet Gospel cements that the Cenobites live in the same reality as Clive Barker's occult detective Harry Damore.
Nice.
The same novel involves the Cenobite Pinhead identifying him as the Hell Priest and the Cold Man.
The Cold Man. I think also, I could be wrong on this, but I think that's how they credit Pinhead in the new movie, the reboot, whatever. I could be wrong. Again, we're going to be talking about that in 2 weeks. So, but yeah, I also will say my edition, even though this isn't about the book, it's a reprint from Harper Perennial. Amazing, amazingly designed cover. The designer is Greg Kulik. I looked him up on Instagram and followed him immediately. Just a really great mix of old school and new school. I don't know. I was really into this cover. I looked at it a ton. someone else talk.
Let me get to Elio's email before we forget about that. And there's still stuff about other things that he mentioned, but still, I'm just going to read the whole thing. And then he will talk about the Hellbound Heart as well. So, here's Elio. Hey guys, I have some more updates for this previous week. I'll talk about my side stuff first. I watched 1954's Dead of Night. This was a really fun watch. I heard it described as like a proto-Tales of the Crypt. Six people meet in a weird cabin and tell stories. They were neat little tales ranging from ghastly ghost tales to stories of premonitions and magic mirrors. It reminded me of The Twilight Zone, and I really enjoyed it. Some excellent acting with that 40s flair. It was a great watch. I'm also playing through Resident Evil 8 Village. I was shocked with how much I loved this game. I loved 7, and 7 had some great Texas Chainsaw Evil cabin-like vibes. It was very scary while being somewhat grounded in reality until the end. It had hints of Saw, Evil Dead, Texas Chainsaw, Hills of Ice, etc. Village is really cool. It reminds me of a modern interpretation of movies from the 30s, 40s, 50s. This might be because I've been watching a lot of movies from that time period. But tackling an evil village with vampires, dolls, werewolves, etc. It's like a who's who of evil horror creatures. I'm about halfway through it and really enjoying it. It's gotten some good scares out of me. Now, for The Hellbound Heart. This was my second time reading it, and I picked up some nuances this second time around that really stuck out to me. I want to write out a segment that read very beautifully to me and made me really appreciate Barker as a writer. And here Elio's quoting the book. Spring, if it lingers more than a week beyond its span, starts to hunger for summer to end the days of perpetual promise. Summer, in its turn, soon begins to sweat for something to quench its heat, and the mellowest of autumns will tire of gentility at last, and ache for a quick, sharp frost to kill its fruitfulness. Even winter, the hardest season, the most implacable, dreams as February creeps on the fame that will presently melt it away. Everything tires with time and starts to seek some opposition to save it from itself. And then Elio goes on. I really loved this segment. It spoke volumes to me about how well of a wordsmith Barker is. I have never heard someone describe this feeling before, but immediately connected to it and knew exactly what he was talking about. The horror is so good in this text, and it's such a good companion piece to the movie. I think the two together really complement each other. You really get a feeling for the characters and the portrayals. Frank is such a creep and great horror character. I also do think Kirstie is the perfect final girl, but that's an argument I'll save for next week with the movie. I'm sorry for the massive email on top of the email from last week. Break it up any way you want, read anything you want, omit anything you want. I won't take it personally, but I'm very excited for these episodes and can't wait to hear what you guys say. Love, Wrestling Flapjack, Elio. So, yeah, as I said before, when we announced the episodes on social media, Elio was really excited, and it seems like he very much enjoyed the writing style again, or even appreciated it anew on this second reading. And my experience, and Dave mentioned that I read the book in more or less one go. I took some breaks, but I was on a train for several hours. So, and that is the good thing. You can't really get distracted much. There's nothing really else to do. So I just kept reading, and at some point I was finished with the book, and it made it easy for me to just keep going because I was really invested in the story. I liked the descriptions, the imagery, and although I have seen the movie some time ago, but still the description in the book felt still fresh to me. And as I said, I like the style, and I think Elio picked a pretty nice segment from the book in his email to represent the writing style, the prose of Clive Barker. I was into that, and it made me want to read more from him. As I mentioned, I read the Midnight Meat Train. I wanted to say Midnight Meat Train Massacre for some reason, because there's not enough M's in the name already.
Maybe because that's a badass name.
The Midnight Meat Train Massacre. And I'm not entirely sure anymore. I may have read the story that Lord of Illusions was based on when we did that movie on an episode, but I'm not entirely sure anymore if I've actually read it. I know we have all the books of blood here, but I'm also interested in Barker's other stories, because there's several novels where he delves more into the fantasy genre. Anyway, so there was something I wanted to say about the book. Yeah, here it is. There was one thing that I was a bit surprised by in the book, which is something that on a different day I may had I might have put down as a minus for the book. But on that day, I found it interesting. And maybe that is something that he did because he was a younger writer. And anyway, I'm going to say it, and then you can tell me if that is something that you would deem normal, or that is something that you didn't notice, or that you did notice. But I found it interesting that at several points in the story, the perspective changes within a chapter. Oftentimes you have it that either a story is told from one perspective only, from one character's perspective only, and you only have insight as a reader into that person's mind. Sometimes you get a story from several perspectives, but then usually those are not necessarily presented within the same chapter. Sometimes like chapters are told from different perspective. But here we have several points, as I said, where you as a reader jump from one head to another, if that makes sense, where the story is told from the perspectives of two characters, where just from one paragraph to the next, the perspective jumps from one character to another, which I found unusual and interesting, but still it worked for me. Is that something that you noticed, or am I crazy here?
I don't know that I actively noticed it to where I was like, oh, this is a, but I also know what you're saying. That's because it is absolutely how he wrote it. From what I remember, and I've read this one full time and then half like three times, Frank Herbert does a similar thing in Dune, where you'll have multiple characters in a room with multiple motivations, and you're getting multiple inner monologues in a lot of ways about what's going on and their reactions and their feelings and everything else. Mm-hmm. To the point that Lynch directly just tries to do that in the movie. He has you'll hear characters' thoughts when it cuts to them, and it's a lot of times just pulled from the book. So I don't know if that's because I'm used to it, or if I think also to me, it's also kind of like a microcosm example of the bigger thing that I was talking about earlier, which is, I think another, I don't want to say meandering, but it's almost very stream of consciousness sort of, and it's flowed where, I don't know. Like, I am absolutely not criticizing this. I love Elio. I've never met him in real life. He seems like the best dude ever. So I'm absolutely, I know how much he liked this passage, and I'm not being critical of it or saying that it sucks or anything like that. The part right after that. So that's the first, that's like three chapter, not chapters, three paragraphs, I think. The sentence right after that is, so August gave way to September and there were few complaints. Which to me is one of those things where I'm like, okay, he said a lot to say that a couple months went by. And so it's, if you're into the style of it, it's, yeah, I totally see the appeal. And for whatever reason, for me, there were times where it was like, it felt, I don't know. I started to say unplanned, but it obviously is very planned. It's very specifically written. He has a voice. So no, I don't think you're crazy at all. I think it definitely is there. Part of me wonders if it was to try to make things more as, not objective, I guess, removed, detached. Like there's not, Kirstie, I guess, would be ostensibly the like hero, or like the morally, the good person, because Frank and Julia are obviously pieces of trash, and, Rory's, I mean, he's not a piece of garbage, but he doesn't seem necessarily like an amazing dude. But I'm not saying he deserved to die. I don't know. That approach, too, makes me wonder if it was an effort to have more of a distance from the characters, so that you, in a weird way. I'm not sure. I don't know.
I definitely got confused at times where the narrative just seemed to skip from one set of characters to another with absolutely no break or mention. It would just it would just move on. It, like, one minute I was with Frank, and then the next moment I was over with Kirsty, and I was like, wait, hang on, did I miss something? So I think, again, it's like individual style. Every writer has got their own style. I think this is probably just a quirk of his. Overall, my enjoyment of the book, like, I was able to follow. As soon as someone's name was mentioned, I was like, okay, we must have moved. But it wasn't necessarily the easiest to follow at certain points, but I don't think it necessarily hurt it for me so much as it was just like, I need to pay a little bit more attention where we are at different times, you know?
Yeah, it didn't hurt it for me either, and I didn't really have problems following it. And I get what you're saying. I'm often an unfocused reader myself and then have to turn back a couple of pages. But with this one, I didn't have to do that. But it is something that I noticed and that felt unusual to me. But that also made it interesting. And maybe it's just maybe I'm blowing this up too much. Maybe this is just a thing that happens in every other novel, and I just haven't read enough of those, or I don't know. But it seemed to me like an unusual thing to change narrative perspectives within a chapter without really, giving the reader this notification of like a new chapter heading or a bigger. Like a bigger paragraph, a jump where you as a reader might be prepared that there's a change coming. Because I neither have read Frank Herbert's Dune nor have I seen David Lynch's adaptation, but I think that's a very interesting thing to within one scene jump from head to head, from person to person, from character to character, and get their perspectives. It's probably when did Dune come out, the novel? Something like the
1956. I think.
Yeah, shippies and drugs. That's probably what made him do.
No, I'm sorry. I said 56, 65, other way around.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it was 56, that is ridiculous.
For whatever reason, my mind heard 65.
Sorry. I thought my mouth said 65.
I think also,
and I'm not backtracking, but I also want to be totally clear that it's a subjective thing in terms of I see the appeal 100%. And there's an often discussed I don't remember how many pages it is, but it's the opening to The Name of the Wind. Actually, it might be the opening of both books, where Patrick Rothfuss describes forms of silence. And I think it's one of those things that, like, if you're on board, if you're clicked in, then that stuff is going to just go over great. Like, but when I talk to people about that scene, it seems to be divided by people who roll their eyes and people who are like, I love that part. You know, it's beautifully written, blah, blah, blah. I think when it gets to a style that I wouldn't call it poetic, but I don't know. In some ways it feels more akin to something like that. Like when I started reading more poetry earlier this year, I had a couple different people send me, you know, passages that like really resonated with them and how much it helped them through certain times. And it's always a weird thing because there are some of them that I read and it clicked with me and I understood it. And there are other ones I read where I was like, this is fucking nonsense. Like, this doesn't make any sense. I don't like how it's written, but I also didn't for a second doubt that it meant something huge to that person. Just because I think it's the same way with Dune. I think there's a reason why so many people try to read Dune and they're like, this is bullshit. It's so, like, why do I have to read hundreds of pages to get to where I'm going to be hooked in? But for me, when I read it, I'm reading Dune Messiah now. I love Herbert's style. So if that dude does go off talking about the flora and fauna of Arrakis for a while, I'm on board. I'm interested in that stuff. I'm connected with it. So I honestly think the format probably has a lot to do with it too, specifically being, I guess now it's defined as a novella. I think literally the cover of my book says a novel, which, okay. But I think having that be a shorter thing too, you're also with these characters for, relatively speaking, not that long. And in terms of like plot points that you can plot out, pretty straightforward and fast. It's not complex stuff. But I think because of that, like the tone of it and the writing style and everything else from the jump, from jumping in with this character who is this hedonist who, you know, is not a character you're supposed to relate to, necessarily, but also, or maybe I should say have sympathy with. But also you're seeing, I don't know, I'm going off on too many tangents here. I absolutely see why people connect with it in a different way than I do, for sure. And it makes me curious to see how his writing style changed. It also, I feel like, would be hard to find. He has YA books, he has kids books, even that Mr. Be Gone novel that I have. That one I'm pretty sure is written from the perspective of the book you're holding. Like it's a cursed book or like a possessed book or something like that. So it's definitely one of those things where I look at it and I'm like, this is not a something that I look at as, you know, oh, well, they're not quite there yet or anything, as much as it's just like, yeah, this wasn't 100% my speed. But I can see why the Cenobite stuff took off, because that is, for me at least, the most interesting, but I think also partially because it's the least explained. The mystery around it and the fact that it's like, you know, undeniably happening. There's no, he doesn't leave any you know, gray area of like, is it in their heads, or like, no, like shit is going down in this book when they mess with this puzzle box. So I'm gonna shut up now.
What you described about Dune is something that people talk about Lord of Rings as well a lot. Remember in Hideous Energy episode from many years ago where you said you're never gonna read that book.
Did I? I bought that book the other day. I'm sure I said that when I was like 22.
I even remember where I was when I listened to that episode, because it was so memorable to me. I thought to myself, you don't know what you're missing. But yeah, I totally get that. There is a flowery aspect to Clive Barker's prose here in this story. And as you mentioned earlier on with Elio's segment, he just could have said some months went by, but he just,
right.
And that is similar to something that we talked about recently when it comes to watching movies. If you watch movies just for the plot, the information, or if you watch movies for the atmosphere, the style, a mood that it conveys through all the other elements that aren't just the words or the plot. And of course, with writing, it is the same as you described with Dune. You enjoy the writing style, so he can talk about whatever he wants. You just enjoy the prose, the way that Herbert puts words together and chooses words for his sentences. And that is something that I really enjoyed with Barker here. His prose, his writing style, his vocabulary. And of course, that is something that we know from Lovecraftian stories as well, to describe the indescribable and the world that Barker creates with the Cenobites and their realm and the tortures and the pain and the pleasure and everything, something that we haven't seen yet. And Barker finds words to describe what he wants, what he imagines in his head and wants to put in the reader's head, and the way that he does that is something that I very much enjoyed. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, on another day, maybe you would have enjoyed it more, maybe you would have enjoyed it less. On that particular day, you were kind of lukewarm on it.
I think also I remember there was one time in the past we were talking about probably around the Midnight Meat Train episode, but Lincoln sent me a message on Facebook, and I'm sure I mentioned it here on the show as well, but he talked about having Barker show up on the scene and how significant that felt at the time. Obviously there's that, you know, very famous blurb that Stephen King, I've seen the future of horror and it's Clive Barker, whatever it is. I think that's also something that I try more and more now, if I'm interacting with anything related to Barker, is trying to put myself into that headspace of thinking, okay, this would have been completely new, completely fresh, completely unseen for people. I think that there's a, especially with things that dabble in or dip or completely enter into the even more specific sort of subgenre of extreme horror. I mean, I don't think this was his crew was classified as that back in the day, but what they called it, what, splatterpunk or something at the beginning, I think. Maybe they still do. I'm not sure. But there was absolutely that sort of separate growth and movement aside from Stephen King, obviously, who I'm assuming, like always, was, you know, a massive figure within horror literature at the time too. So I think that's another aspect of it that I often have to look at and say, okay, I can't look at some of this stuff and just sort of roll my eyes at it and be like, okay, he's trying to shock me or he's trying to be gross or whatever else. There's more to it than that with situations like this. And it took me a long time as someone enjoying pop culture, whether it's comics or any kind of art, I guess, with that sort of approach. It took me a long time to not just immediately write stuff like that off as just to be shocking. I think there definitely are cases where that is the case. Sometimes that's intentional because the author wants to create that specific emotion in you, and there's more thought put into it than just trying to be shocking. Other times it's shallow and there's nothing to it other than just trying to be crude or whatever else. So I don't know. I think about that context a lot when I try to now, at least, after Lincoln mentioned that and how that would have felt. Cause there's, yeah, I don't know that there's been a big analog or like a significant sort of thing like that. I can definitely look at a lot of stuff I've read, by modern authors where I can tell, okay, there's clearly more Barker DNA here than Stephen King. Not to, you know, make that always be the one-to-one comparison, but, yeah, I don't know. I think that's the context around it. Obviously it's impossible to fully do it justice, but it's been important for me to frame it that way.
I still have a note on my phone from 3 years ago with Lincoln Barker's suggestions.
Oh, cool.
Lincoln's Barker suggestions. From and it says, from Books of Blood, The Midnight Meat Train, Scapegoats, Pig Blood Blues, Son of Celluloid, The Forbidden, and then it says, not in Books of Blood, The Hellbound Heart.
Oh, nice. Cool. Yeah, hopefully he listens to this episode. And yeah, I writes in, especially if he has thoughts on Barker's style or how it evolves or whatever else. Yeah, I keep wanting to go back and just be like, it's a me thing. I think that's clear. It's not a criticism at all. I don't think I have any other big thoughts. I didn't take notes or anything. I mean, it, like you guys already mentioned, it felt very, I didn't have to plod my way through it. Anytime I picked it up, I read a bunch of pages, flip, you know, going through it. It's got a nice clip to it. But there wasn't too much where I was like, I've got to write this down, other than the word den. But after he said it that many times, I just remembered it.
Maybe that's a British thing.
it's gotta be, dude, because the first time I was like, what does that even mean? I started to figure out through context. Is it just like
noise?
Yeah. I started to say like a cacophony of sounds or whatever. Like, okay,
pretty much.
So yeah, maybe that's it.
I also kind of like, I need to probably go back and read certain passages in its native Scouse. It's already a pretty mirthful term, the Order of the Gash, but then you say it in a Liverpool accent, Order of the Gash, and suddenly it just has this extra level to it, you know. I might need to read the entire book with a Liverpudlian accent in mind.
you can record your own audiobook.
Yeah, put on YouTube.
Hellbound Heart. I can't back
it. Here International Presents.
He had a drug of urine in case he needed to embarrass himself later.
I think over the next few episodes, we will come back to this story more often when we talk about the adaptation. I know very, very little about Dave Bruckner's film, so I can't even say if that is an adaptation of the novella or not. But
I don't know either.
For Barker's movie, we all know it definitely is an adaptation of the story. And
the one thing I remembered being different, isn't Kirstie in the book a relative?
Yeah, that's
like a niece or something.
Something that I did not remember, but Wikipedia told me that she's a daughter or a stepdaughter or something like
that. Okay, I remembered her being younger and it not being like a love triangle, so I knew it was something different. But
yeah,
I'm excited to watch it. And also, even with the very little knowledge I have about Hellraiser for next week, it's always blown my mind and impressed me that back then, I mean, he directed it, right?
He did, yeah.
Yeah, and I believe wrote it, which is insane. Yeah. Like that, obviously we have the Maximum Overdrive with Stephen King too, but that kind of stuff doesn't really happen. And for it to happen back then, even crazier. So,
and like a year after the story was published.
Yeah,
so insane. I just watched a video the other day where someone talked about the three. It was mainly about Lord of Illusions, making the case that Lord of Illusions is a better movie than most people give it credit for. But one of the arguments was that Clive Barker directed three movies and was good at it and never did it again.
So was it those two and Nightbreed?
Hellraiser, then the Nightbreed, and Lord of Illusions, yeah.
Lord, I didn't remember him doing Lord of Illusions. Cool. Okay. I'm excited. There's a lawnmower outside my door, or outside my window. I'm going
to be. We're not talking about the lawnmower, man. Stephen King is trying to infiltrate our Clive Barker episode. And we probably won't do an episode on Lawnmower Man, especially the movie.
Yeah.
Aww.
No, thanks.
Dave wants to do a Lawnmower Man episode.
Just because of the absolutely atrocious CGI, frankly. I could do with a laugh sometimes.
Back in the day, that was the most exciting thing when that movie came out. I later on read the short story, but back in the day when that movie came out, it was exciting just because of the cyberpunkish computer graphics. I mean,
it looks like the graphics that you would see on a graphics card from a box from back in the day. Like, you know, the ones that had like robots and stuff printed on the boxes.
Oh, on the actual art. Isn't it also not like the book at all? Doesn't the book have nothing to do with computers?
Yeah, nothing.
The short story.
It actually is about a lawnmower man.
Classic Hollywood.
Good lord.
Anyway,
you guys have any I was gonna say, do you have any other big thoughts, or what were you gonna say, Andy?
No, about to wind down here, I guess. I don't really have big thoughts. As I said, I think we will refer back to the short story when we watched or rewatched the movie for next week, and we'll talk about the movie and then we can draw comparisons. And I'm now, having read the story, I'm very excited to rewatch Hellraiser and to just to compare how did Clive Barker go about visualizing his ideas that he only described in prose in this short story, and then it became.
And I think also classic. All discussions of style aside, we all enjoyed it and recommended it. I think I don't want to speak for you guys, but if you haven't read it, check it out. Again, it's very short. You're going to get through it fast. Horror-wise, it's awesome. I think it's also another thing we have to think about, too. We all know these things. Even if you don't know the franchise a ton, there's not going to be things happening in this that you aren't aware of necessarily. But just from a horror perspective, it's awesome. It's got a lot of great horror in it. Next week, Hellraiser 1980.
Seven,
okay. I wasn't sure. Andy, I completely killed your rhythm. I'm sorry. Take it back over.
We didn't do double feature picks, of course. I just remembered, what are we doing at this point? We're doing double feature picks. I didn't pick a double feature. No, we did a book. There's no double feature. There was a lot going on in my head. So, read your short story. Send us emails, eerieinternational@gmail.com. Do it like Elio did and let us know. How did you like the episode? How did you like the story? Did you read the story, or did you watch Hellraiser for next week, and let us know what you think about that movie or any other horror stuff that you want to talk about? Find us on social media and our email address. Thanks for today, everyone. on this podcast and outside of it. I'm babbling. See you next week. Bye-bye.
This has been a production of FanOff.com.
And that's perfect.